I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1972. The album is Monty Python's previous record. The artist, of course, Monty Python, and my guest this week is David Morgan. Thanks so much for doing the show.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your book first before we get started.
Okay, the book is Monty Python Speaks. This is an updated version of a book that we produced about 20 years ago, tying to the anniversary of Python Group forming. And since 2019 marks the 50th anniversary, I've done an update with new interviews, and not only with the Pythons, but also with some of their collaborators, including Hank Azaria, who was a Tony nominee for the Broadway show Spamalot.
Right, right. Oh, that's wonderful. So you've been, I mean, you've written a bunch of things, but I mean, there must be, you must have a passion for Monty Python, otherwise you wouldn't have picked a Monty Python album. It would have been a little strange if you hadn't, I guess.
It's true, I think. I mean, and I have covered the work of the Pythons back since the early 80s. I interviewed Terry Gilliam a number of times. I was on the set of several of his films. I interviewed Python, and so when the opportunity for a book came along, they were all in on it, and so I have covered their career both individually and as a group pretty extensively for the past few decades.
That's pretty wonderful. I'm trying to think. I feel like I must own the original version of this, but I'm looking forward to seeing the updated one. And people can find that on Amazon. They can find that anywhere, obviously. And when does it officially come out, or is it out already? My apologies for not knowing.
January 8th, 2019.
January 8th.
So the new material covers what has occurred in the past 20 years since the book first came out, which includes Spamalot. It includes their reunion show in London in 2014, the reunion in New York at the Tribeca Film Festival the following year. And also includes a new foreword by John Oliver.
That's wonderful. So good. So why did you pick this album out of all of them?
For a number of reasons, mostly having to do with the mix of material. I mean, all of their albums are very generously pulled from sketches that they've done on the TV show or from the film's soundtracks. Monty Python's previous record is about half and half of new material and sketches that are originated on television. So there's a lot of freshness to the sketches that are heard and the songs as well that were written specially for this record. Orally, it just sounds wonderful in terms of the mix, the use of sound effects. It's probably the most Pythonic sounding of their records. This was the third one they did. The first one was actually produced by BBC following the first series of Monty Python Flying Circus. And that was kind of a muted affair. BBC basically trucked in an audience to a theater, and they had them perform the sketches in front of this very tepid audience. It wasn't really very enthusiastic, I guess. The audience, but they probably wondered, what are we doing here? Who are these people talking about flying sheep? So the subsequent albums, it was kind of like the Beatles going from performing live to going to the studio where they experimented. The Pythons just retreated to the recording studio and they did their albums from there. And so they had a lot more control over it. And you didn't have to worry about an audience reaction so much. I was actually almost going to pick Matching Tie and Handkerchief, which was their fourth album. And that was primarily because of the fact that it was the world's first three-sided LP.
Yeah.
You know how many grooves are on an average LP, correct?
I do not.
You take a guess?
Two.
Yes.
Okay. You meant grooves. I was overthinking it.
Yes. No, I imagine a lot of people might say, well, there's probably about 500 grooves. No, there's one groove, you cut a record and spin the round. The Pythons had wanted, with Monty Python's previous record, to actually cut three grooves onto one side. And technically, it just could not be done. They took it to several engineers, and they pulled their hair out, and they couldn't do it. They managed to do it for matching tying handkerchiefs so that there are two sides on one side of the LP.
Yeah.
So depending upon where your needle fell, you would either hear one set of sketches or another set of sketches. The idea being that if nobody knew, they would play their record, put it away, and maybe a few weeks later come out and wonder, well, why are all these new sketches on side of the album? So that actually explains why on Monty Python's previous record you hear the same skit or sound effect of a massage from the Swedish Prime Minister three times,
because
it was supposed to be the beginning of a separate groove within the side of the LP.
Right, right. I like that you picked one that maybe marks kind of a changeover into them. You know, any performer is going to get frustrated with their with an audience that is not attuned to their sensibilities, I suppose. But I like that you picked one that does have a solid mix. Do you have a particular preference for the new ones over the sort of recreations of stuff that was on the show?
Yeah, because it's fresher, and it also gets to use the sound effects, like the bits about are you embarrassed easily, which
yes.
is a sort of test of sounds that embarrass you, and they're pretty embarrassing. Or also the wonderful world of sound, in which you hear insects magnified 60 million times. And Michael Palin's performance is just so wonderful, so effusive and enthusiastic, even though he's got these really loud insects with him. There are silly noises throughout, and there are also songs that were written for the album, like Eric the Hafabee and the Yangtze Kiang sort of football song. So there's a lot of fun.
How far back does your history go with Python and with this album in particular?
Well, with Python, it goes back to the early 70s when their album, such as this, and I'm not sure if this specific one was, they began playing on radio here in the States.
Okay.
Our first exposure to it, really, before the Monty Python's Flying Circus began appearing on PBS. So I heard that. I remember riding in the car, listening to it, just thinking, who are these guys? And it basically started from there. Once the show was on TV, I absorbed everything having to do with it.
Yeah. Well, that's. I had to assume this wasn't just some sort of assignment that all of a sudden threw you into this world of Monty Python. I don't think you could write that book without being a lifelong fan.
Of course, generationally, there are always new Python fans being born. So even if you're 20 years old, you can be.
That is true. So you heard these on radio first. Let's talk about that. Where'd you grow up? What kind of a station was playing this where you grew up? Because I grew up in a time or place where there was no comedy on the radio. They weren't playing really great stuff that I would have loved. So I'm just curious where you grew up, what kind of, what was on the radio other than this, how much comedy did you have?
Well, it was sporadic on New York City radio. Some of the rock stations here, or the college stations, would intersperse music with something like this. I mean, the fans of Python were not that dissimilar from the fans of rock radio. In fact, it was sort of sold with a similar sensibility by the record companies. Rock fans heard this on a lot of alternative stations. In New York, I believe WNEW had it. That was a really big rock station. And college stations as well. And it was through that it started getting a fan base here even before it appeared on television. And what was funny is that you didn't need the visual element of Python in order to get it, even though the visual element is so strong.
Sure.
Part of the shows and the films. So you didn't necessarily need it to get to Joe.
Do you know when you first picked up one of their albums after hearing them on the radio?
Well, I do remember getting Matching Time Handkerchief that came out here, I think, shortly after the series premiered.
Okay.
In the U.S. I remember getting that and discovering that it had three sides on it.
Right. Yeah. That's perfect to discover as a young person. I got exposed to it in my 30s. If I had discovered that, would have blown my mind as a young guy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, off of this album that we're talking about today, previous record, is there anything in here that stands out as a particular favorite, either of all time or of the record itself?
I think the sound effects skits I mentioned earlier are probably the favorite from things that originated on this album. The Erica Hafabee song is a lot of fun. They had done that sketch in the second series, but they expanded it with a song for the record, and that was written by John Cleese and Eric Idle. And it's ridiculously fun.
Yeah.
What's also kind of interesting is that for the CD, when they re-released a few years ago, they did add a bunch of bonus tracks. And these were actually recorded several years after the fact for a different record that didn't make it onto mm-hmm. that LP. And those were primarily sketches from the third series of the show, but they're hilarious.
Right.
And they also did a few radio ads for the Monty Python books that had come out in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. So they're a lot of fun to hear.
Give me one second. The phone here is just saying, okay, it's being a little, something shorting out here. Oh, no, there we go. I think I fixed it. Boy, oh boy. There we go. So was Python something that you made friends over or shared with your friends? It rarely seems like something, unless you're growing up in a super rural area, it seems like something that really grows and expands when you've got a ton of friends who are quoting it with you the next day at school.
Yeah, there were a number of kids who got it, as it were, and so we had our little coterie of Python fans. In fact, once I remember when I was sort of grounded from watching TV, and I had religiously been recording all of the Python shows,
mm-hmm.
and I managed to get a friend of mine to record it that week.
I love it. That's so sneaky.
So we protected each other.
It's so good. Oh, that's wonderful. I'm curious about your experience as an American listener. How much of your memory of this is like, holy crap, like, of course it's incredibly funny, but the accent. I feel like the accent is a big part of it if you're not English.
Well, I suppose we have a certain veneration for the British accent. It makes everything sound a little more grand, which means in the hands of Python, it just punctures pomposity so much more easily. But I was kind of familiar with British humor because prior to the series coming here, radio in New York City was rebroadcasting The Goon Show.
Oh, really?
Which featured Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan, and Harry Secombe. And that was the BBC radio show from the 50s that was sort of a precursor of Python. Of course, it was radio, but they used extensive use of sound effects to produce these really ridiculously insane stories, if you could call them that.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of the radio version of Python, and it was a great inspiration for each of the Python. So I was kind of familiar with the Goon Show humor, and so I could recognize a lot of that in Python.
I'm curious about, in writing as much about the Pythons as you have and speaking with them, I'm curious if anything of interest ever came up in your discussions with them about this record. I don't know how much detail you went into the making of the record, so we can talk about it.
Well, it was a very sort of the recording of them was kind of low rent. The Pythons, after they had the experience with the TV show, they wanted to branch out into other areas. They had tried a movie. The first film wasn't a happy experience for them, and now for something completely different.
Yeah.
So they didn't feel that they had a lot of control over it. But they start venturing into books and records, and they, with the books, they were just throwing out all these ideas and coming up with unusual ways to try to package them. I think any book publisher looking at one of their early books that have all these cut-ins and inserts and things, wondering, like, you know, what are they doing here? It's not a simple process, because they were thinking how to make this as unlike a book as possible in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And they were probably doing that with the recordings too. It was a very amateurish affair almost. They were recording them in, at least in the beginning, a recording studio that had been set up in someone's garden shed in the backyard.
Right, right.
And they would then take these recordings then to a proper studio to clean them up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But they were like creating the sound effects themselves and just almost like kids playing at making a record.
Yeah.
And I think that enthusiasm, that kind of childlike effort was, of course, passed down into the recording itself in its joy and its enthusiasm and passion.
You know, my favorite best produced albums, and they're pretty much on opposite ends of the spectrum in some ways, are the Python albums and Cheech and Chong, and they have that in common, that there's so much, even though they ended up, like you say, getting polished, and then eventually, you know, Cheech and Chong have very big producers involved, they still went out and recorded their own sound effects and stuff, which I did not know. So it's insane to me that it's that hands-on, and therefore it's their signature throughout the whole thing. Like their fingerprints are all over it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know the story with Cheech and Chong with their first album.
Mm-hmm.
They were invited to a record executive's office, and he said, "Well, do you want to make an album?" And they were like, "Well, I see all these gold albums on the walls. Yeah, I want a gold album too." "So what do you need to make an album?" "Oh, okay, well, give us a tape recorder." And that's basically what they did. They gave them a tape recorder, and they recorded an album.
I love that so much. That is so incredible. And the difference between them and, like, I've interviewed people who have done quote-unquote vanity presses on this album. The difference between the two is, you know, one had this huge ability to just get publicized like a son of a bitch, and just the world gets to see this insane thing they put together. Exposure is such it changes so much of any artist's work. So it's interesting to me I had Tommy Chong on the show, and I don't think that even came up. So I love that story. That's so wonderful. So was collecting Python records something you continued to do, something you continued to do now? Do you still have them?
I still have the LPs in a box in the closet. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's things you just can't get rid of.
Of course. Sorry. Can you still hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, there we go. Okay. Thank you. What is wrong with this phone? Okay. So where, I'm curious then, did Monty Python then introduce you to other comedy? Did you have a continuing interest in British comedy, things like that? Or did it sort of like, obviously, you loved it enough to write a whole book about it and write another book as a follow-up, basically, an update of the book. I'm just curious what they might have led you into after this.
I'm not sure about British comedy per se, although, of course, I'm kind of an Anglophile, so I'm interested in British television. I've always tried to look for other similar comedians, and there aren't really many like them.
Right.
In fact, I think the closest that ever came to it was the Whitest Kids You Know.
Oh, yeah.
Their TV show was probably the closest to Python in terms of the structure or lack of structure, mm-hmm. and their willingness to just to do just about anything, no matter how crazy, and along with their willingness to put on dresses.
Doesn't hurt.
No.
I'm curious how many times you've been able to see the Pythons perform live.
I did in New York in 1976 when they had their first show in New York.
Amazing.
In terms of performing, that was their only show that I saw them live. I did also see them live at the Tribeca Film Festival retrospective a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
And about 2 years before that, they were given an award in New York City by the British Film Academy. I'm not sure why they picked New York to give them the award, but they had a reunion then at which a little girl from the audience came up onto the stage and performed the Spanish Inquisition sketch.
Oh, my God. That's
I'm not sure
bizarre.
If that's... Are you... I'm sorry, are you hearing that feedback? I'm hoping that's not ruining everything.
I am not hearing any feedback on my end. Is it like echoing or something for you?
Well, I've gotten some feedback, but if you're not hearing it...
No, I haven't heard anything yet. No, nothing. That's strange. That's very funny to me, though, that that's the most bizarre version. What was seeing them perform on their first tour in America? I don't know. I can't imagine that experience. Like, how did that feel to get to see them for the first time?
Well, it was like being the fan of, say, the Rolling Stones, getting to see them live for the first time. Of course, it was thrilling. And I was still quite young, so it was just ridiculous fun. To see Terry Gilliam hanging in the air, being shot with a shotgun and having all of his guts pour out onto the stage. Of course, that's funny.
Of course. So brilliant. Did you... Yeah. That's wonderful. Do you remember all the sketches they performed, or do you just know by now, you know kind of what they were doing at the time, and it was kind of all the same from each show?
I kind of know, and of course, you have a record album of the show that comes out.
Sure.
So you get to know all these things by heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sketches you know by heart. I mean, I look at the track list for Monty Python's previous record. I don't really have to play it again, really. I can just play it in my head.
Of course. Do you have a favorite song of theirs?
I guess it would have to be Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Mm-hmm. Just because it's...
Brian.
I mean, honestly, I mean, it's both brilliant and beautiful at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard.
And it really means something. It's not just a sort of joke song or novelty song. It was integral to that film.
Yeah. It's interesting to me, though, because, I mean, I think a lot of us grow to love Python in the beginning because of how incredibly, how surreal it can be, but not necessarily how it, the great story they're telling. But once we get to that part of their evolution as a group, is there a relief? Like, what was the feeling for you? Like, because it's new, it's not, you know, that's not a sketch movie per se. So I'm curious what that evolution felt like to you the first time you're watching it, because to express an interest in like, oh, well, this song wasn't just a joke song, which you're absolutely right, but it's interesting that matters to a fan of such an insane group.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, Holy Grail is, in a sense, a bunch of sketches tied together by this search for the Holy Grail.
Yes.
It wasn't a single story as Life of Brian was. You couldn't really pull a bit out of Life of Brian from the film and have the rest of it stand just fine.
Right.
It was part of their progression. They were looking to do new things beyond a simple sketch. I mean, the idea of breaking the rules of sketch comedy was what brought them together in the first place. They really were tired of writing sketches for other comedians like David Frost, Marty Feldman, and so forth. Where they had to adhere to those comedians' dictates that a sketch will have a setup, there'll be some funny jokes, and then you'll have a punchline at the end.
Right.
And so often you get sketches that where the end didn't quite live up to the premise of it, or it wasn't as funny as the stuff in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So Python was just fine with let's cut off the sketch halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
You get the concept, you get something funny, and then you're off to the next thing. And they tied all these little bits together with the stream of consciousness animation from Terry Gilliam.
I think we sort of forget that there's this strong human artistic motivation behind what just seems so, you know, feels, it's so kinetic and it feels so random to people, but you kind of forget that it's got this very human motivation to not want to be stuck in a rut.
Yeah, yeah. And while they were doing the TV show, they did experiment on a few occasions where they would have one very long sketch for almost the entire length of the half hour, or mm-hmm. indeed for the entire half hour. And that seemed to be revolutionary for them.
Yeah.
Of course, it may have looked like a normal half-hour TV comedy because it told one story, but it was new for them.
Right. So by the time you ended up writing the first book, I'm curious, who were you as a person and as a fan at that point that book comes along and this is like the perfect thing for you? I'm just curious how a relationship developed where you got to write the book, what it meant to you at the time?
It meant a lot to me at the time.
I bet.
As a journalist, I had been writing for Los Angeles Times, Hollywood Reporter, a number of other publications, Sight and Sound Magazine, Empire Magazine, a lot of film coverage, of course. And part of which was also covering, say, Terry Gilliam's work. In fact, I also worked with Criterion as a producer on their special edition of Brazil.
Oh, wonderful.
Writing all the background material on the making of the film and even recording some commentary for them.
That is the one Criterion thing that I have. So, that is the one that I have held on to my DVDs of because it's
well,
also
well, thank you. Because that's the set that, and you're familiar with the story of Brazil, where Terry had cut his version of the film. It was co-produced by European and American company, Universal. And in Europe, it went out fine, but Universal, the head of the company, said, no, I can't release this the way it is. It doesn't have a happy ending. It's not, just don't like it. And so Terry was engaged in a very public fight with them. When are you going to release my film, Brazil? And he ended up having to surreptitiously screen it for the LA film critics. And so at the end of the year, even though the movie had not been released, the LA film critics picked it as the best film, best director, and best screenplay of the year. And that embarrassed Universal so much, they just threw up their hands. Well, we have to release it now.
Yeah.
But what they didn't realize, what Terry didn't realize, that during that time, Universal had hired an editor to come in and create his own version of Brazil, one with a happy ending. And it's really atrocious. It's one of the worst edited jobs on a film that you could ever not hope to see.
Right.
But when we did the Criterion package, we included that version because it's really key to understanding why Terry fought so hard to get his version out there.
Yeah.
You realize this is what Universal, what Hollywood wanted to put out, and they would have put it out if they hadn't been shamed into it by the LA film critics. And so I was able to record a commentary track for that version explaining all the things that they did to it in the editing room.
This is now why your voice is familiar. I may have forgotten the name only because I bought that thing in college, but mm-hmm. yes, there we go. Because
yep.
It's one of the reasons I like that box set is, and especially, I mean, I like the things that Criterion does, but there's this, it serves an archival purpose as much as anything else. Because I love the idea of not only just knowing the steps, but knowing what can happen to a piece of art, why it happens, and not forgetting, you know, the ways in which something can be torn, ripped of its soul so quickly, you know, but it's also good to be able to see, oh, this is what it looks like when that happens.
Mm-hmm. And the other fun thing was that when Criterion reissued that set on Blu-ray disc a few years ago, they didn't want to pass over a lot of the written material. The original Laserdisc had a lot of written text streams that you can just flip through. And they didn't want to do that. We wanted to do something for the scenes that Terry either had storyboarded but hadn't shot for one reason or another. So I actually took his storyboards and animated them to go along with the reading of the script for that scene. So I got to animate Terry Gilliam's storyboard. That was like one of the highlights.
That's ridiculous. That's so good.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the friggin' dream. That's amazing. Go ahead. Sorry.
But the passion that Terry brought to that fight over Brazil is very similar to the fight that Python brought on many occasions to try to protect their material. This was true in the 70s when ABC Television bought the rights to their final six half-hour shows that were produced in 1974, and they showed them on late-night television. And what they did was they took three episodes, and then the other three episodes put them into 90-minute time slots, which meant they had to cut out 25 minutes for commercials.
Mm.
And on top of that, they were cutting out things for network standards and practices that were just ridiculous.
Ugh.
Like when a character mentioned Naughty Bits, they cut out Naughty Bits.
Wow.
Naughty Bits, yeah. And so the Pythons actually took them to court. And there was an appearance in court. This would have been late 74 when Michael Palin and Terry Gilliam were sitting in a courtroom downtown Manhattan fighting ABC Television. And during this court appearance, they actually screened both versions of one of the half-hour shows.
Oh, my God.
And then one that was cut by ABC. And you can see there. Like at one point, Graham Chapman plays a character who gets very aroused by woody-sounding words. and he gets so aroused that his wife dumps a bucket of water over him to cool him down. Now, of course, they cut that bit out on the ABC version. So it goes from you see Graham Chapman sitting in the chair, perfectly dry, and then he gets up out of his chair and he's soaking wet. And you're like, what? What is going on here?
My God.
And if you didn't know, you just might think, oh, it's the Pythons.
Right, right. Oh, my God. You know what? That's now making me think that there's a court transcript somewhere of this entire thing happening, and I would love to read it. Holy crap.
Yeah, there is actually an excellent New Yorker magazine piece from that time that goes into it. So, barring a transcript, that was a really good recount of it.
That's so good. Good God, that's amazing.
they ultimately won. They did not get an injunction against ABC showing the second trashing of those episodes 4, 5, 6. That went out, and it was pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
But then they managed to settle, and in the settlement, the Pythons won back the rights to all of their television shows.
Wow.
Which is kind of unheard of. I mean, people who produce television, I mean, the stars generally don't own the shows themselves.
Right.
It's usually the production company. So they actually own them, and they were able to then sell them around the world. And so those six shows that had been cut up by ABC did ultimately make it to PBS. We could see Graham Chapman getting soaked with water.
That's so amazing. This is making me wonder. I know we already talked a bit about, you know, the stories about the making of this record and the making of other records. In general, do these come up in conversation? I don't know how many times you've interviewed these guys or met them, but I'm curious how often the records are considered part of the narrative that they talk about, if they are.
Talking about Python nowadays for them is like ancient history.
Yep.
It was a very intense period for a few years, doing the TV shows and then doing Holy Grail, and then regrouping to do Life of Brian, and then a few years after that, regrouping to do Meaning of Life. And then that was basically it for a long time.
Right.
In which case, during which they went their separate ways and they did their solo projects. I mean, John Cleese had Faulty Towers, and Michael Palin has been traveling all around the world. Terry Jones did books in all variety of genres, from humor to children's books to medieval history. Eric Idle would go on to do Spamalot. He also did The Ruddles for NBC television. Terry Gilliam directed several films. Graham Chapman died. So beyond all that, this is kind of ancient history for them, which is why it was extraordinary when they got together in 2014 to do the reunion show in London. And they had to do that because they came out on the losing end of a court case. And in order to recoup the Python coffers from all the lawyers' fees, it was suggested to them that they do an arena show in London. And so they basically rebuilt the show that they had done at the Hollywood Bowl around 1980 and at Drury Lane in London some years earlier. And they freshened it up with some new bits. And they announced it, and when the tickets went on sale, the show's tickets, 16,000, were sold in 43 and a half seconds.
Holy God.
Yeah. So then they said, okay, well, we have to do another show. So then they added a few more shows, and those sold out like that. And so they ended up doing 10 shows, 160,000 seats sold out. So there are a lot of Python fans out there still, and a lot of them are young. They were not alive when they first came on the scene.
Yeah. If it's ancient history to them, I'm curious how you see your job in writing that book originally and updating it now. I mean, there's an element of historian, even if it is for comedy.
Well, I would bristle at that. I mean, a historian is a historian. I mean, you could be talking about Magna Carta, or you could be talking about the fish slapping dance. It's still a vital function.
Agreed. Believe me, this is preaching to the choir. I'm always interested because you never know if people look at themselves that way or if they, some people are like, I don't want to call myself a historian. It's comedy, but I like that you embrace it.
Yeah. Well, certainly in terms of the Pythons, I embrace it.
I'm
fortunate to be able to document their history and to try to do what I can to preserve it.
Mm-hmm. What about your point of view? Because there are some books, obviously, that the gentlemen have written themselves. Other people have written Python books. But I'm curious, what about your point of view is important to understand in these books? I mean, are you trying to, do you remove yourself from it in terms of you don't get too editorial, or is that also part of it?
Well, I think I bring the passion of a fan, but I also understand a film history background, I understand what goes into producing films and television. I'm sorry. Can you just repeat the question again?
No problem. It was kind of a convoluted question, so don't worry. I'm just curious if you know, like you say, this is kind of an historical document. You are tracing the history of a very convoluted and complicated history of a group that's been together for 50 years. How much of your own personal opinion or your own personal point of view makes it into the book, or does it need to enter the book, or is that necessary? Is that a necessary or unavoidable part of it because you're a human being?
Well, point of view, of course, I may point to certain things that are of most interest to me. I don't necessarily get into, wow, what was it like writing that sketch?
Right.
That specific sketch. It's more about their relationships and their working professional relationships. You know, how did these six individuals end up creating a sort of comic persona that was unlike what any of them did individually. And if you look at their work, you know, Cleese's, Gilliam's, Palin's, whatever, their humor, it may have a strain of Python that you kind of recognize, but it could be more structured. it could be more familiar in terms of narrative arc. It doesn't necessarily look Pythonic, and yet when the six of them got together, they were producing something that was very unique.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it had to do with their differing personalities colliding, and the fact that there were these teams working within the Python team. John Cleese and Graham Chapman worked together as a writing team. And then you had Michael Palin and Terry Jones working together as a writing team. Eric Idle was writing off on his own, and Terry Gilliam was doing his visual material on his own. And they would all get together, and they would read out material. And you could see that their personalities, both within these individual teams and within the group, really can collide, in a sense, and balance each other. John Cleese is a very controlling personality. And he worked with Graham Chapman, who was the loosest, most uncontainable in terms of just coming up with weird ideas out of left field. You know, he would just say, splunge. And everybody would go, oh, splunge? But then you had to deal with it. It became part of the comedy equation, E equals MC squared splunge. You had to, like, insert that. And then that became a Pythonic thing. And so there was this tension there between the two of them. And then you had a tension between Palin and Jones, where Palin is probably the most convivial, nicest guy in the world, is wants to get on it with everybody and does. And Terry Jones is very emotional and can be antagonistic because he'll want to prove his point. He's very good at arguing politically, for example. And so he'll be right in there for an argument about why something has to be a certain way, and he won't accept it if it isn't that certain way. And so he'll necessarily be putting heads with John Cleese. And so you have these factions sort of going at war within the group Python. But they all had to work together, and the fact that this tension was there, I think that added tension to the comedy.
That's, you know what, you had me at referring to them as a group, as a character, which it had never occurred to me to think of them in that way. But that's, you know, when people refer to, oh, that's so Python-esque, oh, it's got this je ne sais quoi that is very Python. But if you treat it as the group as a character, it's a new way to look at it, and I really like that.
Yeah. Well, if you think of a certain comic persona, think of, I don't know, Buster Keaton, W.C. Fields, Charlie Chaplin. They worked at creating a character that wasn't necessarily them, but you recognize it as them, and their humor was filtered through this character. And I guess the humor that was created by Cleese and Palin and so forth was filtered through this Python character, as it were, even though the character had six heads.
Right. Oh, that's wonderful. What I like to do to have people is to have people break down why listen to this album. Let's say people only know Python from the show, or they only know the movies, or they only know them separately somehow. They don't know that much about the group. Why listen to this album? Not necessarily first, but why is this like a critical album to listen to?
Well, I think it's a great introduction to their style of humor, which is, and certainly in the case of a recorded album, it doesn't necessarily fit a style. If you think of comedy albums, my first thought might be like, you know, Richard Pryor, like a stand-up album.
Sure.
And this is not like that. And yet this is also not like a radio show that with an audience with very predictable laughs or laugh tracks. This is just insane little bits that are strung together with some music and sound effects that take you from sort of parodies of radio or TV shows to these kind of insane ideas, like putting an eclipse on a record.
Right.
As if it were a sports event. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can't see it. It's a record. What's the point?
That's beautiful. I really appreciate you talking to me about this, not just this record, but your history with it, because you have a unique history, because you had the opportunity to turn your extreme fandom into this expression of love for the group that is also an exploration, and that's kind of wonderful. Let's tell people again where they can find it, where they can find you online, anything you want to tell people about.
Well, the book, Monty Python Speaks, will be out in early January in the U.S. from HarperCollins and in England from Fourth Estate. So you can buy it at bookstores or online, both regular actual printed pages and an ebook.
You can also read a lot of my interviews on my website, Wide Angle Close Up, which is at wideangleclosup.com.
Perfect. David, I really appreciate you doing the show.
No problem. Thank you very much. It was a fun.
Thank you so much. And thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years.